Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Buju Anin
Danach A at Anzenu Shook with An
Tante
Ay Inuhadikay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Anin Buju, my name is Melissa Spence, and I'm your host for the Anishinaabe episodes. I was born and raised in Treaty 1 in what is now known as Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Both of my parents are Anishinaabe. My mother is from the Lake Manitoba First Nation in Treaty 2. It's on the Dog Creek 46 Res, a small community on the northeast shore of the South Basin of Lake Manitoba. The same place where my mom's mother, my grandmother Brina, who passed before I was born, is from. My mom's father, George, was from the Sandy Bay Ojibwe Nation that's located on that same Lake Manitoba, but on the west shore. We are lake people. My father is from the Kisikoos Ojibwe Nation in Treaty 4, where both of his parents, my beloved grandparents, Mary and Tom, are also from. I am Anishinaabe, and I am so very proud of that. We're a big bunch when you look at a map and trace our territories. We straddle the invisible Canadian-U.S. border as nations, from Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, even Quebec, to Wisconsin, Minnesota, and with some of us even wandering as far off to places like Oklahoma, and like me, who lives in southern Nevada. I've even met Ojibwes living in Arizona. Like I said, we are a big group of people. As far back as my Anishinaabe bloodline goes, I don't speak the language. I don't have a traditional way of introducing myself. I don't have a spirit name. All I know up until this point is that I am from the Turtle Clan, and I am the granddaughter of residential school survivors and the daughter of two 60s scoop survivors. My mother was placed in a foster home with well-meaning Germans. She went into the foster home speaking Anishinaabe Mohin fluently and came out unable to speak her language, although she still understood it and would translate it for me as I grew up. My father's numerous foster homes were so horrific that to this day he's unable to speak about them. Therefore, I know little about him as an Anishinaabe, other than that he was taken at the age of 3 and aged out of the system completely traumatized and culturally annihilated. So when I was approached to consider being a part of Words and Culture, I was stunned. But something inside me immediately said, yes, do it. This is how I will begin my own journey back to my language, Anishinaabe Mohin. For years, I worked in Winnipeg radio as a personality and music programmer. These days, I work for myself as a voice artist and audio producer on Southern Paiute land in what is now known as Las Vegas. My own journey to reconnecting with my culture began in 2018 when I quit drinking and started to really feel what it's like to be alive. And since then, the culture has been showing up here and there. Learning Anishinaabe Mohin is a huge step for me, and I am more than happy to share it with you. Together, we're going to hear from other Anishinaabe from both sides of the U.S. and Canada as we explore this incredible, sophisticated, eloquent, and beautiful language, and how it's not just surviving through generations, but thriving. My first guest is Anishinaabe Barbara Nipinak. Words and Culture producer Kim Wheeler and I visited her in her Winnipeg home during an early spring day. Barb is a pretty busy elder who visits and gives prayers and openings to several events each week in Treaty 1 territory. When we arrived, she was resting but greeted us with smiles and warmth before she started to share her story. I spoke with Barb about her love for her family and for her language and how the two intertwine.
Anin, nishubinesi kwendishi kenemi wis. Makwanto wadem. My name is Dathu Thunderbird Woman, also known as Barbara Nepenak. I grew up in a family of 9 girls and 2 brothers. When people were being snatched away during the 60s school or going to residential school, my mother had gone to residential school, but my father didn't. But she was only there a short time. But at the time when children were taken away, she always used to warn us that a truck would come one day to pick us up. And she was a very protective mother. And when that day came, she hid us underneath the bed. And she shut the curtains and locked the door. And at first, I didn't know what it was all about. It wasn't until we came out of our house and you didn't hear any children laughing and you couldn't hear anybody. There was just intense feeling about being where we were at, you know, and all you could hear was women crying. I'll never forget that moment when we came out and my mother said to us, "Don't say anything," she'd say. "Don't ask for your cousins." And she knew what was happening, but we didn't know. I mean, I was about 6. And I remember laying underneath that bed, looking at my nails like this. And I guess for me, as a child, trying not to listen to what was happening out there, I'm looking at my nails. I'm so paranoid about having dirty nails. Even to this day, when I look at my nails, I can't have dirty nails. You know, just little things. And I remember laying underneath that bed where my hair was just all over my face because we're sweating. I mean, I guess that's, for me personally, that's how I dealt with my trauma. But at that time, I didn't know what it was until the last 15, 20 years, people started talking about trauma. And I used to think, oh, that's what that was, that feeling was about. But when we talk about language, my mother always spoke to us in our language. We grew up in a traditional setting. We were raised in the language. Both my parents, my grandparents, they all spoke our language fluently. And as we were aging, my mother would say, always use the language you know best. Already at that time, 6 years old, she would teach us ceremony. She would teach us protocols. And I used to think, everybody must know this. But that wasn't the case. A lot of people don't know protocols. They don't know their language for various reasons. One being they were taken to residential schools and stuff like that. That was a reality. But we always kept our language, and we always used, my mother always used to say, when you pray, you always introduce yourself with your traditional name, because that's how we are recognized by our relatives in the spirit world, and the Creator recognizes that because that's our natural name. So I've always done that, and even to this day, I'm in my 70s now, and it's so natural for me just to introduce myself in that way.
So you always spoke your language. There wasn't a time when you didn't.
No, I even think in the language. And that's the thing, you know, when you come to an urban area, you still think in your original language. And then if you're working in an environment where it's all English spoken, you have to be quick and to be able to think in your mind how you respond to that. It's just a technique that I developed over the years. It's just something that I just developed that skill. Even today, I still do that.
Do you dream in the language?
I do sometimes. I do also in English. And you know, when I dream and I hear myself talking, it's just so real. I've had losses recently, and I remember I was dreaming about my daughter and the way she used to address me. See, in my language, Dan is his daughter, and I had 4 daughters, and that's just the tone of how I would address them. They knew, if they were all sitting here, and I was saying, Dan is, they knew who I was talking about out of the 4. So, and I remember I had dreamt of my daughter here not too long ago, and I was just dreaming in the language. And then I just turned around, Dennis, I said. And then I just, because I felt her presence there. And then I looked and she was gone. And it was just a dream that I had. But I know I addressed her in the way she would have known my, how I would call her.
Did you teach your children your language?
It was difficult because we grew up in an urban area. Nobody spoke the language in this area. It was predominantly all Caucasian people here. They do, two of them did understand. But when you're immersed, the only time that we interact with them is after work and in the morning. But of course, I was one of those moms. I went to work every day, and for 35 years I worked, and my husband worked too for the government. And so the little time we had together with them as they were growing up, because that's when you learn your languages when you're growing up, it was very challenging. But they understood that.
Yeah, we spoke with someone who was addressing the trauma that's built up in people who were removed and didn't grow up with their language, like me, for example, and how there's a block in maybe even our throat area that could be holding us back from learning. Do you have any thoughts on that, of people who are removed? Is there really a block for you that you've noticed when encountering people?
Yes. Just yesterday, I spoke. I was at a gathering, and then I spoke to this man who was standing beside me, and then I said to him, "Ani kinesiyaya," and I said, "So how are you feeling today?" And then he said, I don't understand the language." No, I can't apologize for that. You know, but I just pray for him. Oh, I said, I just asked you how you were feeling, I said. But I do notice people that, not to be judgmental or anything like that, there's a lot of people out there that don't have that language, that don't carry those teachings because they were taken away at a tender age when they should have been learning the language. And it's difficult. You can't assume people know everything. You can't assume people know the language or the protocols or how to pray. You can't judge that. I always wait for them to say something first before I say something.
So how do you approach someone who's that disconnected when you're trying to teach?
I always tell my story to them. I introduce myself in my language, and I tell them where I came from. And then I switch over to English, and I just say to them, I just ask them where they grew up. When people say, I grew up from this area or that area or this reserve, whatever, you can always tell that they grew up in a residential school or day school environment.
So what's your experience sharing your language with your community? Like, what's your role in your community, would you say, when it comes to the language?
Well, my role, I wear many hats. Mm-hmm. And I always say, like, when on social, especially on social media, oh, you're all over the place. Yes, I'm all over the place because people reach out to me. People call me. People say, can you come and do this or can you come and do that? I always try and accommodate them. Because I'm finding that a lot of our relatives, a lot of our community members have passed on. Those were the knowledge keepers. Those were the language speakers. And I find that if I get that call, I go when people ask for me to be there.
And what's your connection like with people, the non-Indigenous community, as a language speaker?
I'm very well respected in that community because of my accomplishments. My husband and I, we did a lot of work with the public, and we were accomplished in our careers, and people respected that in the Caucasian world because, you know, our values as Indigenous people are different from what other people want from an individual. You know, they look at you as being successful because you're accomplished, you got a career, you know, you have children and you have a house, you know, those things, material things. Other people recognize what you do.
So when you began to learn English, what were some of the major differences?
Well, when I spoke my language, while I still speak my language. But when I was younger, when I went to school, I was so excited to go to school because all my sisters went. And I remember, we were living on the reserve then, I remember they'd be going off to school, they'd be sitting there. Oh, I was always wishing it was me going off to school. And then when I did go to school, I didn't understand the teachers. And it was so traumatic. I don't know if I was frustrated or angry or whatever, but I didn't. Because my mother was illiterate. She couldn't read or write, you know. But I tell you, she was one smart lady, you know. And which is why today, because of my inability to speak English, the nuns would grab my ear for I don't know how long. It was forever. My ear was already forever bleeding. There was always blood coming down here because she would literally lift me up like this and carry me to the front. And I can remember just walking on my tiptoes, and she dragged me over there to the front to humiliate me. And my cousin sat on my right side. He didn't speak English. We were the same age. And then he was grabbed on his left ear. It was only like 15 years ago we both realized, yeah, we're both deaf. I'm deaf on the right side, and he's deaf on the left side because our eardrums are perforated. And I remember talking to my sisters. I said, why was I always bleeding? I said to her. Oh, I said, because kaigi don't you listen, does he? She said, you didn't listen to what they said. I guess not, because I didn't understand the language.
Couldn't listen. Awful.
And you know, my cousin's still alive, and he's a year younger than me, and we laugh about that. And then he said to me, he said to me, are you still deaf? He said, yeah. I said, me too. It turned it into a joke. But you know what? We're okay. We survived. We're in our 70s, and we survived. And because of our will and your drive, you know, you have to have purpose. You know, and when I was put into this world, I didn't know what my purpose was. It wasn't until later on, when I had my children, they were all moved away, then I realized my work wasn't done. And then when my husband got sick, I said to him, I'm going to quit everything. I sit on about 10 boards and advisory capacities and stuff. I'm actually the advisor to Lieutenant Governor and a bunch of other organizations. But I'm making change. With these organizations, I am involved with the evolution of change. I am not afraid to venture out and take on new tasks. Like today, I'm doing a webinar. Who would have figured, eh? An old lady like me doing a webinar. But, you know, you have to go with the flow. You have to go with the change. Otherwise, you get left behind and you become stagnant. This is my view.
How has the language changed since you were a little girl with your mother to now with all the technologies?
I find the language has changed a lot because people tend to shorten it. They do a lot of slang, and I see the difference. So when I interact with somebody, I try and keep my language as simple because I don't talk that slang. I try not to talk that slang. Because what you say to people could be very impressionable in how you say it. And then they would say to me, oh, I never heard it said like that. I guess not, because that person who said that to you is taking shortcuts, is missing the essence of what the meaning is of the word. And I see that quite regularly now. Then you see these people learning online, or going to university, taking a credit course. But it's a lived language. You have to live it in order to retain it. I find you just don't take a sentence and then, oh, you learned this. You learned this animal. You learned this action for this animal. It's not as simple as that. It has to connect. The sentence has to connect. It just doesn't. Like I've seen people, you know, learn about verbs and adjectives. Well, those are just a word. It's not a connection. And that's the difference I see today.
When you say retaining the essence How do you retain the essence? You just use the original words.
Yes, the original word. I use those original words because those were the true words.
Right.
I find that with the slang, the meaning is different. What you're actually trying to say is different because it's shorter, you know, it's marginalized, and it's not a kind language. Like in our language, in our original old-time language, our language was very kind and considerate. But now, just as an example, let's say if you have somebody that passed away, you would say, Kishkob Magize. That person has come to the end of his life. You just don't say, oh, he died. You know what I mean?
Right, I see what you mean.
Yeah. Whether you say, Kishkonam, or took his last breath. You know? It's when you say, he died, it's a cold process. You don't visualize what had happened just before he or she took their last breath. That's why I say the language itself is a very kind language. Like, I mean, when my husband passed away, you know, it was tragic, of course, but also at the same time, for me to let him go in a spiritual, because I sang to him in our language. His traditional name was Seven Eagles. I in my song to him, I said, Mishimachan, just go in peace. Fly with your seven brothers. I will know you are watching me all the time. And you know, he died so peacefully because I released his spirit.
There's a spiritual aspect to our language that gets lost when you apply like a colonial lens, like you said, to take the shortcuts. That really gets lost then.
Yeah.
That descriptive spiritual part of it.
Yeah, because the language itself has a message. Mm. You can always tell a person who knows their language how they enunciate their words. You know, how they say things. And you get the essence of what they're saying. Whereas you get these whippersnappers that come along and they'll say, Shawinimin, I love you. No, that's not the way you say it. You would say, I honor you. Mm. Just because I'm older than they are, they want me to accept them as new learners of the language. And to be quick kind of thing, they'll say something like, oh, you know, I love you. No, you don't. You just know the word, how to say it. You would say, Kisagiyin. Kisagiyin is like, I hold you close to my heart. There are differences how you express your love for other individuals.
And that's what you mean when you say you need to live the language.
Yes.
Use it in your everyday.
Yeah.
Not just a time to learn it.
Yeah.
Being in Barb's home as she spoke was incredibly soothing and welcoming. It was great to be surrounded by her whole life. Art, photos, treasures that she's collected. We're going to hear more from Barb when she teaches us some Anishinaabe Moin. But before we get to that, I want to play a song for you.
If we want to be seen as an equal, if we want to be free as a people, then plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds.
Our maze, planting the seeds and feeding of the people. Today my boys grow to be strong men. I teach by example, they break the cycles of oppression. The gifts to my world as I witness their actions. I see their kindness, respectfulness, and old soul wisdom. My love and I grounded, nothing can stop us. Our family is the circle pushing out with the collective. And so if we wanna make a change, we must learn how to swim again. To understand the water is to understand the sun. And to ignite our power, we must collect to the power of one. Cultivate my freedom, true responsible awareness. And by turning up the soil, we seed our dreams and bury resentment. The reason why only how we plant the traditional way is to harvest our decisions to revolutionize each day. Plant the seed.
Plant the Seeds by Anishinaabe and Mohawk-led couple Shoshona Kish and Raven Kenetakta, Digging Roots. They're one of my favorite bands, and I encourage you to catch them live if you ever have the opportunity. I asked Barb to teach me some Anishinaabe Moen and centered the language around family.
When you say Danis, Danis represents a grown woman.
Danis.
Danis. But let's say you women here, I don't know how old you are, that's irrelevant, you would say, Nichique.
Nichique.
Nichique. You're the same woman I am.
Oh.
That's what that is.
Nichique.
Yeah. But I can't call you Nichique because I'm way older than you.
Right. So what would I call you?
See, in our environment, in our showing respect, you would call me your grandmother.
Mm.
Out of respect. We're not related, but that's how you show that respect.
No comments.
Yeah. And that's how you should address your, like my sisters, my surviving sisters, my daughters, if and when that happens, when I'm gone, my daughters has the right to adopt my sisters as their mothers.
And the word for mother?
Nima. You know, the old word. Okay, this will be a lesson. This is a powerful lesson. When I was a child, we referred to, because there's no gender in our language. It's an old word. It's dede. Nde is heart. Dede is heart to heart. That's how you would I would have referred to my mother. Dede.
Dede.
Yeah. Nde, meaning your heart.
Dede.
Dede. Dede. You know, our words were so powerful. The language was so powerful because it had meaning. And you had a feeling from to say to my mother, de, de. Not only does it express the respect I had for her, but the love and the connection and the bond that we had. Because here we are, you know, talking to each other as two individuals, de, my heart, your heart. You know, that nobody uses that word anymore. That's a very old word. But occasionally I hear it. And I feel good that somebody still uses that word.
My mother is my heart, and I'm so grateful for learning Dede. My Dede has always taken such good care of me my entire life. Even on that day when I visited Barb, She made me breakfast, washed my clothes, and as always, asked me what I wanted to eat the following day. She truly is Day-Day to me. I'm well aware of how much of a privilege that is in our communities. Chimigwech for listening to Words and Culture. It's been a really cool experience to not just hear my relatives in the previous episodes, but to be here at